Good afternoon. I know many of you are still working on your desserts or other parts of your lunch, so if you would eat quietly. I was ordered to stand up and start at 1, regardless of where you are in your lunch. So, my name is Steve Goldsmith. I'm associated with the innovations. I have a lot of trouble figuring out who I am because here's the problem. We have 3 sponsoring organizations this lunch, and I'm affiliated with all 3. Which means I can use the same hour to discharge my obligations to every one of the people that I owe. So this is a really exciting moment in my life. I'm the director of the Innovations in American Government program at the Kennedy School, and delighted to introduce to you one of our award winners in a moment. Many of the approaches I attempted, and some of which I succeeded in using in Indianapolis, were derived from the Manhattan Institute, where I was a chairman of their Center on Civic Innovation, and I thank Larry for his hospitality today and for his, I mentioned this every time I speak before the Manhattan Institute, but here's the way this works. Larry tells me what to think, and I do it, and then he invites me back to speak because I have such good wisdom in my choice of ideas. So, nice to be back. And I'm on the board of the Fannie Mae Foundation, and the Fannie Mae Foundation has chosen to provide, in partnership with Kennedy School, an award in housing and community development. And as you know, because you're here, these issues of affordable housing and homes for working families, not only in New York City, but across the country, are extraordinarily difficult issues as the housing crisis, the percentage of family income necessary to have a decent home continues to go up, supply can't meet demand, and a whole host of other issues are there. And it's not, I think, reasonably likely to assume that all those problems are going to be solved with federal dollars. So the question becomes, how can we be innovative in what we can do? And the Fannie Mae Foundation chose to partner with us in making a $100,000 award to the most creative, annually the most creative, innovative solution in housing and community development. So I'm delighted on behalf of all those organizations to welcome you, and I'd like to call on Lisa Mallory Hodge, who runs this area for the Fannie Mae Foundation, to introduce our speakers today. Lisa.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon. It's just really a pleasure for me to be here and to see just the diversity of what we do and what we think. And I think we're going to engage in a real interesting discussion this afternoon. I'm really looking forward to it. It's just a pleasure to be here with the Manhattan Institute. We've been partnering with them for some time, and we support their efforts to recognize innovations. And also the Ash Institute, and we've been working with them for 2 years now, recognizing innovations in affordable housing. I just recently had the pleasure of participating in the final review of some of the finalists for the Ash Award a couple weeks ago in Boston, and it was just amazing. There were over 1,000 applications, and the process that they go through, it is so incredibly, it's just so incredibly wonderful to see all of, and you know, we only get one winner out of each category. We support one winner here, as we did last year, and I'll talk a little bit about Mercedes and her group in a moment, but there are wonderful things going on, and it's just striking, it's just striking to see the determination and the perseverance of these folks that are toiling out there every day, particularly as they support affordable housing, but in other areas as well. So enough of that. I'm going to take a moment to introduce 2 of our distinguished guests today. I'm going to introduce Brad Lardner first, and then I'm going to introduce Mercedes Marquez, and they will both be speaking. Brad Lardner is the director of the Pratt Center, and he previously served as the executive director for the Fifth Avenue Committee, and he's done a great job, and I know many of you, as you've recognized him, he's a superstar here. He has a lot of folks in the audience. I was watching as people said, I came here just to hear you, and he's just thrilled to be the part of this today. We were talking about that earlier, and in sharing some of the work that he's doing. During his tenure at the Fifth Avenue Committee, Brad increased the staff from 6 to 60, and actually the budget to $9 million. I'm also really pleased to share that Brad is one of our Fannie Mae Foundation James A. Johnson Community Fellows back from 2003. We actually support leaders in the field for a year to do a fellowship, and Brad was a recipient last year, and that was quite an event and adventure, and it's really good to see Brad and all the wonderful things that he does. He's also an adjunct professor of city and regional planning in Pratt's Graduate Center for Planning and the Environment. And then I also would like to recognize Mercedes Marquez, who is the general manager of the Los Angeles Housing Department, and she became the general manager in January of 2004. She has a staff of over 500, and she's responsible for the direction and development and implementation of citywide housing production and preservation programs. And Mercedes was formerly vice president of McCormick Barron Salazar, which is a national firm specializing in the development and consultation of urban communities. Mercedes is representing last year's ASH Award winner, and so it's really a pleasure to listen to what has been going on since they actually received the award, and Mercedes will update us on what is presently going on in LA. So I will ask Brad to come to the podium. Thank you so much.
So it's really a wonderful honor to be here. I owe such a debt of gratitude to the Fannie Mae Foundation, and I'm a longtime fan of Los Angeles Housing Department and of Mercedes' work. For those of you that know me, you know it's a little more unusual for me to be invited to speak at the Manhattan Institute, but I have really great respect for the work that Julia Vitula-Martin and Hope have been doing at the Center for Rethinking Development, and I'm really honored for the invitation, so thank you. So a developer, a planner, and a housing inspector walk into a bar. Bartender takes one look at the developer and knows his plan is to knock the bar down and build condos, so he thinks he's a threat. Gets into a conversation with the planner and realizes he's got some cockamamie zoning scheme to zone alcohol out of zones that are within 500 feet of the school that's across the street, so he thinks he's a threat. Little does he realize that the LA housing inspector actually has a PDA under his coat and is recording all the violations in the public areas and the housing units upstairs, and that's where the real threat comes from. When Julia Vitula-Martin asked me to participate today, I was enthusiastic because of my respect for a long time for Los Angeles' great systematic code enforcement program, well before it had won the Innovations Award. And she gave me two challenges. One, she said, you know, it seems like what they do is systematically go through and enforce the law, and they have a nice database, but could you help make it kind of funny and entertaining? And could you give some New York City context? And I said, well, as you saw, I sure can't make it funny or entertaining, but maybe I could give some New York City context. As everybody, I think, in the room knows, it's wonderful and exciting and sexy to create new affordable housing. And we love to develop it. We love to build it. We've got a great new plan in New York City to build something like 94,000 units over 10 years. But I think you're here because you recognize, at least in part, that in many ways it's even more important to preserve what we have. Not only because it's less expensive and the history of trying to do it is longer, but because the scale and the numbers are simply much, much bigger. It's millions of New Yorkers that live in housing that's affordable today. And while it's less sexy to figure out how do we make sure it stays affordable for the long run, I think there's a good argument that it's even more important than creating what's new. Let me just give a couple of thoughts about what's sort of similar and different between New York and Los Angeles on this issue, and then talk about kind of a quick update on New York City strategies in preserving affordable housing to give some context for what Mercedes will tell and bring us some great ideas from Los Angeles. The similarities, I think, are obvious to us, right? Enormous population growth, largely as a result of immigration, and increasingly sort of polarized service economy, so lots and lots of new people at the low end of the income and wage scale, with rising prices, both rental and ownership, making it ever harder for that sort of folk to find a place in the city. That means more crowding, that means people paying more of their income for rent, and more people facing affordable housing. And it means challenges for conditions. In some cases, people will withdraw services as they're thinking, how can I maybe get rid of the current set of tenants and get somebody in here who would pay a little more? And some challenges for neighborhood livability as well, as growth puts pressures and strains on a whole range of neighborhoods. And as you know, so you have a whole set of people, and I was looking at the numbers as I got ready for today, but the housing cost burdens, very similar in New York City and Los Angeles. The rental vacancy rates, extremely low, very similar in New York and Los Angeles. And actually a lot of similarities between the affordable housing preservation strategies that I'll talk about for just a minute, preserving the existing privately owned but publicly subsidized stock, rent regulations, and then code enforcement and conditions. There certainly are some differences, and those largely revolve around scale. New York City's got about 2.2 million rental units, Los Angeles something like 800,000. Average age in New York City dates back is 1949 as opposed to 1960. Interestingly, crowding is almost twice as high in Los Angeles, so one area where I think we feel the pressures here, actually much more of a challenge in LA. And then from a preservation point of view, New York City just has a much longer and bigger history of developing affordable housing with state, especially Mitchell-Lama, and federal and city subsidies. So over its history, New York has built something like, or had built in it if you count public housing, something like 430,000 units of affordable housing over the time. Whereas in Los Angeles, it's, you know, I think it's something like a, you know, maybe even a tenth of that. It's certainly just a lot less robust history. So they've got a lot of catching up to do, and I think it's why focusing on the private market through code enforcement makes so much sense. But let me just take a minute on each of those strategies, on preserving the existing stock, which is an enormous challenge in Los Angeles, and they're doing a number of innovative things there, and a significant challenge here trying to preserve something like, you know, between 200 and 250,000 units of privately owned but publicly subsidized development, Mitchell-Lama, HUD-subsidized, low-income housing tax credits. Community Service Society just came out with a report that says something like a quarter of that stock had been lost to affordable between 1990 and today, and something like 15 to 20% of it is at risk going forward in the next few years as a result of the expiration of the subsidies and the regulations that go along with them. So really just a significant crisis. And both New York and Los Angeles are grappling with this, trying to think about it as a portfolio problem rather than putting out fires one at a time, thinking about new regulatory tools. You know, the mayor has legislation in Albany trying to extend rent regulations to cover the set of developments that were built post-1974, to put some regulatory incentives for owners to keep them in the programs, and then come up with new financing strategies to enable both nonprofits and for-profits to acquire them and keep them affordable for the long term. And I think both New York City and Los Angeles facing challenges in dealing with HUD and getting what's needed from the federal government, especially on the federally subsidized stock, to try to keep it affordable for the long term. So we may be able to talk a little bit more about that. Same is true in public housing, where I won't go into the details, certainly, but New York City recently announced a significant new plan to try to preserve the 180,000 units of public housing that it's got, relying on a $100 million commitment from the city. Rent increases on the top quarter of NYCHA tenants still wouldn't pay more than 30% of their income for rent, and essentially project-basing about 8,500 Section 8 housing cost vouchers. That's probably become the most controversial part of the plan, since that's obviously a scarce resource that, if it's preserving public housing, is not available to go to new folks on the waiting list. The second area, and the one I have to confess I'm the most excited about to get to speak positively about from the Manhattan Institute platform, is rent regulations. New York City and Los Angeles are two of the only cities in the country that have a significant program of rent regulations. And while I'm sure it's not fashionable in this room to say so, I think in the kind of economy we have at this moment, increasingly polarized, growing population, need those low-wage and low-income workers for the set of service jobs we have, I can't imagine an economy in which you might not conclude, boy, if we don't do something to regulate and make sure those folks can stay in their homes, how could we think the city would work? If we thought it was something we needed for returning veterans in World War II, seems to me we ought to think maybe it's necessary for the immigrants we're asking to come here and do the service work and the healthcare jobs and the retail jobs that our economy's creating. One significant difference there, both cities regulate housing that was built basically before the 1970s. New units are not necessarily covered if they don't opt in for some reasons. One significant difference is that Los Angeles has essentially full vacancy decontrol. So it's regulated with an existing tenant. You can only have an annually set increase. I don't know if their annual increase setting process is as contentious and ugly as ours. It's hard to imagine.
It's not
actually. Very good. Well, maybe we can learn about that. I don't know what Marvin Marcus will do, though, if he doesn't get to moderate between the shouting of that. But essentially, when a tenant then moves out, the unit is able to go to market. And as you know here, advocates have felt that, in fact, the creeping vacancy decontrol as a result of units being decontrolled when they get to higher rents has meant, you know, now some probably somewhere north of 100,000 units leaving the rent regulation system and being lost as a regulated affordable resource. So that's the second significant area. And then the third one, which we're going to hear so much about from Mercedes, and where LA has just truly been a leader, is in code enforcement and housing quality. So let me just say a word or two about what's been taking place in New York City. Overall, general conditions in the city, in housing and neighborhoods, has been improving over the last few years and over the last decade as the city has gotten stronger and its economy has rebounded, and you just see it looking around if you remember what New York City was like. At the same time, there are a significant number of places and buildings where housing conditions are bad and, in fact, a little bit worsening. There was a slight uptick from 4 to 4.9% of the housing stock from 2002 to 2005 that has five or more severe maintenance deficiencies per unit. And it's, of course, concentrated in low-income neighborhoods in Harlem and the Bronx and central Brooklyn. As a result, partially of innovation from HPD and partially from pressure from community groups and advocates, several new things are being tried right now in partnership with the city. One is, I think, just entirely kind of blatantly ripped off from Los Angeles. You know, they call their program SCEP, and the new New York City program is TCEP, very veiled. That's the Targeted Cyclical Enforcement Program. You'll hear that LA inspects every unit. We focus on those buildings that are in the worst shape, and every 2 months in three city council districts, HPD, a city council member, and the community group sit down and target the worst buildings for enforcement. That will inspect 7,500 units or so a year. If that's all we were doing, and it's not, but at that rate it would take us 293 years to get to the entire city. So there is some difference between the program of trying to cover the entire city and targeting the worst buildings and the worst places for improvement, and it might be one thing that we want to talk about. There's certainly been some real significant progress made since that new program was adopted just a few months ago. Another thing HPD has been involved at, along with advocates through a group called Housing Here and Now, is getting the banks more involved. New York Community Bank, which was one of really the worst offenders, but has agreed to this wonderful new compact, along with Citibank, and they're putting pressure on other lenders to join, have said they'll get involved. And when buildings that they've lent to have housing conditions problems, they'll do more. They'll inspect those buildings. They will put money in escrow before they complete the loan on a building. And they'll look at the track record of owners before they lend to them in the future. Again, a new effort that I don't think we can know the results on yet. One challenge, and I'm real interested to hear how this has gone in Los Angeles, is around enforcement. Both of those are around sort of inspections. Unfortunately, in New York City, there's a real challenge going from a notice of violation to that violation actually being improved. And the numbers are something like, HPD says, only 25% of violations are removed within the time frame that they're supposed to. There are something like 2.7 million outstanding violations, including nearly 500,000 that are Class C violations. One challenge is, unlike a parking ticket or something else, it takes extra court action for a notice of violation to turn into a fine if you don't fix it. And so one thing advocates are pushing for is some way that it could essentially convert more easily so that we would see those units really fixed and fines levied if they don't get fixed. So that's sort of a quick overview of some of the issues facing New York City in preservation. And again, I think all of us in the room feel like we're lucky to have the partner that we have in HPD. One thing that they've really done to send this as a signal is that over the last couple of years, they've put a couple of our worst offenders in jail. And several landlords they've taken to court and sent them to prison for a few days and said, this is breaking the law and it's jeopardizing people's lives and we take it seriously as a violation. I think that is the kind of tone that we want. At the same time, it's a big, big challenge, and we're lucky to have colleagues around the country, and in this case, Mercedes Marquez from Los Angeles, to come and shed some light on things that we might do here to make those conditions even better. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring greetings to you from Los Angeles. The weather's kind of similar today. I'm grateful. And particularly from our mayor, Antonio Villaraigosa. He's become a great supporter of this program, and it's just wonderful. I was at something with him recently, and we were talking about housing production at a press conference, and he actually pushed me on the arm, and I've known him a long time, so he's pushed me on the arm. He says, talk about SCEP. And that didn't used to be how it was, because it is not a sexy thing, right, to talk about inspection, something that it's a grind, right? It's every day, with enormous focus and commitment to make sure that it happens. First, before we get in, thank you so much for the invitation to the Manhattan Institute. We're thrilled to be able to come and share the work. I can tell you that the inspectors that do this work, SCEP as a whole is about 215 people. And this is what I would call the meat and potato guys. right? Every day out in the street, they don't get a lot of recognition, and so I'm happy to come and represent them here today. And of course, also thank you so much to the Ash Institute and to Fannie Mae, both for your recognition and for your continued support. It's been a wonderful journey. And just this last 6 months, we've had various cities come to visit. Dallas, Texas has now adopted an ordinance very similar to ours in Los Angeles. The building inspector, the commissioner of buildings from Chicago and the mayor's office in Chicago has come to visit with us. And we've received a letter now from New York, and we're expecting them next month to come and tour with us. So there's no question that the efforts and the mission of the Ash Institute and Fannie Mae in this regard really do work across the country. And it looks like many people will benefit as a result of that recognition. I won't go into so much of what our condition is in Los Angeles. We are certainly not, unlike New York, the perfect storm of an affordability crisis. All the things that Brad spoke about are true: soaring prices, land costs, construction costs, rising housing prices that are rising, you know, over the last 15 years at several times the rate of inflation, while wages remain flat, have all put us in this kind of horrible situation. I think also in Los Angeles, we have very low area median incomes, much lower than, for instance, our sister city in San Francisco. In our city, 100%, right? So the area median income is $69,000 for a family of four. In San Francisco, it is $113,000. So you can imagine right there, that is the kind of jolt of reality for those of us in Los Angeles that really makes it difficult for people to get into home ownership. And the gap on what rents cost, an average rent these days for just your normal two-bedroom apartment in LA is about $1,500. And someone at half of median income, you know, so many of that's where we are, the gap is about $800 between what they can afford and what it costs. And it's just rising. I'm sure not unlike New York, but because we're tied to area median incomes and all kinds of formulas, when you look at funding, it just makes it very difficult for us. And so the one thing I can tell you about Los Angeles is that we accepted a good while ago that we cannot simply build our way out of the housing crisis. And so we were forced to turn away from only having a production department to really focusing in on preservation. I think also comes with that an understanding that we would prefer the housing department to act as a public sector entrepreneur, to push in the right direction and then get out of the way, so that we're really working with the market. And that's very difficult for government. We'll always be behind you. Right? We'll always be behind. But to the degree that we hold it as a value and we're paying attention to it, it seems that our success rate is better. So we are doing that. So as a result, a dual focus for us on preservation and on production. Let's talk a little bit about how SCEP came to be and how it works. SCEP stands for Systematic Code Enforcement Program. And it is true that at this point we are the only city in the country that actually inspects each and every unit, not just the outside, each and every unit itself. And, you know, how did it come to be? One, I think what is most important about this is it was done in a very open public process. We had a crisis of our housing stock deteriorating to the degree I was telling them at the table at lunch that we had a situation where, when I was a practicing lawyer, we were actually filed a RICO action against Savings and Loans that were churning these buildings. So much so, truthfully, that one of the bank officers' black Labrador retrievers was a signatory on documents. That bad. So, and we began to see how the buildings were just being milked and churned. So just in time, the mayor was talking about what happened in his city, that as they were chasing after these bad guys, they'd move owners, and you'd have to start the due process all over again. And that's exactly what we found in Los Angeles, and it was enormously frustrating. And that RICO case was brought by the private firm that I was at the time with the city attorney's office, the only time that the city attorney has actually partnered with a private firm to bring the case. And we ended up winning in the state Supreme Court, but it did very little to change the conditions of the buildings or tenants or anybody else. So, you know, I guess why I don't practice law anymore. So we've moved from that, and we ended up forming a citizens committee, and it was led by the person who is now our cardinal. He actually asked the president of Loyola Marymount, a Jesuit, to chair the commission. There were tenants, there were landlords, there were elected officials, there were neighborhood folks, there were housing officials, you name it, and they were involved in a blue ribbon subcommittee. And eventually what they came back with was a true understanding and study of how it was that the city did code enforcement across the city. Where were all these policies? And of course they found that there was no coordination, that the responsibility for code enforcement lay primarily with the building and safety department, but who also had responsibility for all of the commercial buildings and focused largely on permitting. And let's look at it practically speaking. If you're an inspector and someone is waiting for you at a 50-story tower and they're welcoming you and you have a lot of power in that situation and they need you to work with them, what is more sexy? Let me go work on this new tower, or let me go to a dispute between a single landlord and a single tenant where you're almost involved in what seems like a domestic violence situation, right? Because by the time a tenant gets the nerve to complain, it is ugly. And you go in there and you're fighting back and forth. So what if you have discretion, what are you going to do? You're going to do what's easiest for you because there's nothing holding you to having to go to those situations. And that's what happened there. So eventually, the recommendations were that a new program would be created and that it would be moved out of the building and safety department. I can tell you that that caused pandemonium in the city. The inspectors in building and safety were very upset. They felt that they had been denigrated. And so it took something to actually politically get it moved from one department to the other. But it ended up being, I think, the fundamental reason why it works. Because now there is no confusion about mission. The Building and Safety Department continues to be responsible for all of the inspection of commercial properties. And now the Housing Department created its own program with a group of people who have a clear mission and pride about what they do. By inspecting now systematically, it also took out this issue of conflict between landlords and tenants. Because an inspector is not being asked to have an emotional reaction. Right? They're not being asked to function in that way. They go in and do what is their job, objectively take a look at the law. And we protect them as much as we possibly can to ensure that they work only in that sphere. So that when we go to enforcement, it is not the inspector who works on the enforcement case. And I'll talk a little bit about that. So, a new system. I think what's also important is that we looked at it very much as a public sector entrepreneur would, as a business. So we look at the idea of enforcement and compliance, I would say, as a conveyor belt of work. You just keep moving, you keep moving, you keep moving, and time does run out. The ordinance has very specifically taken out the discretion of the inspector. Right? So it is not this idea that you go and you say, más o menos. No. If you are not clearly within the first time period 60% completed, you cannot get any kind of an extension. And anything beyond that, your boss has to write a memo and say why it should be granted. And so, you know, in government, if you want something to move in a direction, you make sure that people have to take time and write it down and get it approved. And it's amazing how they move toward compliance and away from finding a way not to get the job done, because now it costs them time to not get it done right the first time. So you move them in that way. You incentivize them to the path of least resistance is to get it done. What we've ended up finding is that we have several tools for enforcement. One, a very important thing. We have now finished our first round. It took 5 years to inspect the approximately 800,000 units. We are done now, and we have studied the data. And what we have found is this, that 80% of landlords comply within the first period. So we're able to focus on the more difficult cases. But we also found that an additional, might say, let's see, 13% within the next round comply. So we're really only left with 7% of the buildings where we have difficulty gaining real compliance. In the end, the department was able administratively to gain 99% compliance. That means we only send 1% or 250 buildings a year to referral to the city attorney for criminal prosecution. So we're able to get it done all of ourselves. And what we have found is that the 80% of the landlords that comply as good business people very much now appreciate the efforts on those that are more difficult, because now you have a great landlord on the block and across the street, you know, one that's not so great. But because of this compliance, everyone is rising, the neighborhood is rising, and so are their property values. And so we have found a real kinship there, so much so that when we first started the program, we were actually sued by the Apartment Owners Association, went all the way to the state Supreme Court so that we would get the right to do the inspection program. When the Kennedy School came to take a look at our program as a finalist, we introduced them to everyone. They had lunch with the same apartment association that sued us. At the end of the lunch, after the representatives at the Kennedy School had left, they said to us, "What do you think our chances are of winning?" So we've come a very long way from the state Supreme Court to now doing joint property management courses together. And why I believe this ultimately works is because we keep talking to each other all of the time. We actually do teach together. Tenant groups are doing outreach, and everyone can come in with a complaint and it's listened to. And so it continues to be a very open process. You know, that's unusual in government, but we've found that the only way we're going to get a neighborhood program done is if the neighborhood is involved. So that's where we are. We are now taking a look at something called RISE. We invented it. It's a way of giving a score to the buildings as we went through the first process. And those that are at the lowest score, it means you start at 10, and for every difficulty, you lose a point. Those are then at the bottom of the score, means they were not complying. They're the first ones we're going now to reinspect. And we're now mapping it. We now have maps for every city council district. And it tells us which census tracts have improved, which have not. Not only do we target them for enforcement first, but we're also targeting our rehab programs there, both multifamily and single family, and doing everything we can to make that work. I hear that you're a lively audience, that you have many questions, and it's always more fun to answer questions than it is to just speak at people. So I'm going to stop and look forward to your questions.
So Brad, why don't you and Mercedes both come up here and you can call on folks, and there's terrific presentations. I looked up briefly during the rent control part, though, and thought for a second I saw Lenin's statue to my left, but not quite. So but why don't you two take turns, and I'll get out of the way, and we'll go for about 25 minutes.
Just wait for the microphone.
Yes.
I never thought in public I'd be ever saying anything about good about the French, but let me ask you to respond to what I believe was the French system. I'm not sure whether it's still operating today. They got out of the housing inspection business entirely and made it into an insurance matter. And so it becomes a parallel to having a car. So I don't have to worry about the building inspector, the car inspector of New York City coming to visit my car. I have to worry about the insurance company upping my insurance. Now, what would you say to the possibility that the insurance company has a much greater stake in making sure it's a good building than a building inspector, because the insurance company has to make money off of the building? And indeed, many insurance companies today have whole branches that go around in the construction of the building saying, don't do that, that's going to be a fire hazard. Don't do that, that's going to be a safety hazard. So let me put it to you sharply. We'll close down everything. Building inspectors, rent boards, all that kind of stuff, and simply require, as it is in New York State, that you have to have insurance for your car, you have to have insurance for your house, you have to have insurance for your building. So that if a tenant has a problem, you know, there's garbage in the hallway, things like that, they go to the insurance company and they want to have a judgment against the landlord. Now, if you have landlords that are chronic offenders, they can't get insurance. And so what happens is they can't buy a building because the law is they have to insure the building. That's the only thing you enforce, is you have to have a certificate of insurance. And so since they can never get insurance, they exit the real estate market, leaving only people who are good landlords. So what you've done, in effect, is privatize the entire process through the insurance process, much like you do with cars.
Well, thank you for the sharp question, and let me make a sharp response. It doesn't work. And let me tell you why. You assume in your fact pattern, actually something about enforcement rather than preservation. In your outline, it requires when somebody gets caught doing the bad thing, that's when they get caught. Here we're talking about a mandatory minimum, right, a maintenance program, which is different from getting caught for being the worst offender. I will also tell you that I spent many years litigating against landlords who fail to meet their responsibilities. And that means, of course, when you're in these cases, who do you deal with? Insurance companies. So I have dealt with, I can't even tell you in my own practice how many insurance companies who hadn't a clue, who while they're involved in inspecting for new construction, are not in any way involved in inspecting for liability once it's built, particularly for the older buildings. And I would come into a case, we might have a rent-a-judge to go through the process of settling the case, and I would have a carousel of photographs, and I could break down by each insurance period all of the violations and the damages that were suffered. And they would look at me in utter shock. I had insurance defense lawyers tell me, actually, I can't do this anymore. It is so terrible. But it would take 3 years, and you're going at it one at a time. So when you're looking, the difference here is that we're trying to maintain a minimum so that nobody ultimately is a bad landlord. Now, eventually, we may get to the point, if they believe us, that we'll get to a minimum that can be contained. But I'll tell you that one of the reasons in New York that you have the problems that were laid out by Brad is because they don't believe the government will enforce. They don't believe they'll catch you. They don't believe that they'll have the person power to go look. And that means that the people are willing to play the game of risk. And that's what's happening. It may be in our future, but right now it won't work. And it's about preservation, not about enforcement.
Can I give just two thoughts on this? First, I don't know about you. Every year I have to take my car and get it inspected, actually. So I'm insured against accidents at this sort of one time. But I'm inspected against things that harm others, like air pollution. And just so it's, you know, it's not garbage in the hallway we're talking about. It's peeling paint. It's no heat. It's no hot water. It's no locks. It's in the worst buildings. We're not talking, I agree, we're talking about a pretty small percent of folks. But it's a percent of folks with a business plan. And if the law is not enforced, they're going to do everything they can to figure out how to get around it. Now, that said, I love the new effort of trying to get lenders involved, which is not so dissimilar in some ways, right? Because the part of the compact that several lenders have agreed to is we will look at a landlord's portfolio, and if they have too many maintenance violations in their other buildings, we won't lend to them to acquire a new one. So I do think that there are ways to involve the market better in getting bad apples out of the market. But I don't see how, if it doesn't begin with, here's the legal standard and we have to enforce the law, and if you don't, those couple percent of people that don't comply with the law then experience some of the other consequences that we're talking about. So,
in fact, the insurance inspection laws don't work.
Sir?
I'm Michael Myers, New York Civil Rights Coalition. Basic question to you. This affordability notion. What is its definition? What is there a standard definition for affordability? I think I heard you say $1,500 in Los Angeles for a two-bedroom. That's not only affordable in Manhattan, it's a steal. I'll take it, without a subsidy. is there a universal standard for a definition for affordability? Now, the second question is for both of you, and that is with respect to the demolishing of urban projects, and the subsidized housing now going, at least in New York, going into the free market. Big people lost their tax benefits, and the landlords want them back on the free market. And with respect to the new buildings, which are supposed to be affordable, are luxury housing. You have a real reduced number of apartment houses, for example, available to people who cannot live in those apartments without some sort of subsidy. With the subsidies, however, it's not just an inspection of the premises and the building. It also comes with an inspection of the occupants. There are a lot of these questions and conditions that the occupants must be examined, not only in terms of their income, but in terms of their family households, in terms of their criminal records, in terms of the criminal possibilities of family members who may come and visit the family. So there's an inspection of the family and the occupants as well, which comes into questions of privacy. So those are my questions to you. There's a trade-off here, because you're not just inspecting buildings, you're inspecting families.
I will respond to the last question, Brad, mainly a New York question. In the inspection program, we also cite tenants. Absolutely. So if there are pack rats, if they're running a business out of their unit, if they're leaving oil all over the street because of cars, so much so that we started a special enforcement unit that works in the late afternoons and evenings and weekends to focus in on those very specific problems. So that we often work with city council offices to identify a tenant that is causing a building for the entire community in that building. So in that sense, while certainly the bulk of the work is building, you know, is unit by unit, if they're violation, we also cite them. You want to talk about the...
Sure. I think one thing that unfortunately low-income people get used to are a range of ways in which if they want the subsidies and programs that are available, they give up a meaningful amount of their privacy and dignity for it. And it's not good. On the one hand, the waiting list for New York City Housing Authority is several hundred thousand families long, and for every affordable housing development that we built in my previous job, there were 20 or 30 times the applicants, even though folks knew every year they were going to have to come tell us this range of things, and we were going to come inspect the unit. Affordability. The sort of technical definition is that it is targeted so that the people who live there will pay no more than 30% of their income for rent. But it doesn't tell you what their income is or therefore what the rent will be, because there are affordable housing programs for very low-income families, for low-income, for moderate income, for middle-income, many different programs with many different guidelines, which are sort of targeted to try to get housing to be affordable to someone paying a third of their income for rent. Now, in New York, it's something like 60% of people earning less than $25,000 that pay more than half their income for rent, so if they're not living in subsidized units. So we have, and that's true for moderate and middle income people as well. So, and it's almost always a question you get, and I think the problem is it's there's passionate fight over scarce resources because there are lots and lots of people who can't get the housing that they want, and they think someone else is getting it, right? And so the trick is, of course, you know, that there's not enough of it to go around, and so, you know, we used to feel like, well, if we're able to develop one affordable unit and we upset 30 other people, all we had done was made 20, you know, those 30 people mad at us. But I do think that people all around the country are recognizing we have to mean something mixed income. You know, the biggest New York State affordable housing program ever was this Mitchell-Lama program, which served moderate and middle income families. And then government policy kind of got away from that, really focusing on the lowest incomes. And while people know we still absolutely need to focus on the lowest incomes, we also need an affordable housing policy that's meaningful to moderate and middle income folk facing the pressures. And that does mean balancing scarce resources, but it's something that's very important to do.
Yeah, I'm just one comment on insurance companies. When I was in the Parks Department, we required a construction bond from all of our contractors. They had to be insured. So in case the contractor went broke, it was just, you know, one guy in a truck, could collect from a large company. But we found that not a single company ever paid on these policies. They defended with all sorts of ruses, and all we got out of the bonds was a lawsuit against an insurance company, except rather than one against the tiny individual. So it really was totally ineffective for profit-seeking insurance companies to be counted on to do anything. That's not in their immediate cheap interest. Now, my question is, you've been doing this some years, is there any difference between the various mayors, say, starting with Mayor Koch? I know in a housing program, there have been four mayors, Mayor Koch, Mayor Dinkins, Mayor Giuliani, Mayor Bloomberg, in their attitude towards housing and in their performance.
Wow, all right. Only one of them is currently mayor, right? So there's an easy answer to this question. No, exactly. Well, one thing I would say is and I think this was behind what we're both talking about, the times are so different that what you've got to do with housing policy is really remarkably different now than it was 20 or 30 years ago in times of abandonment. And so the crisis that Mayor Koch was facing, trying to bring the city back, with housing policy is quite different than trying to make room for people who can't afford housing as the city is resurgent. And partly as a result of that, he was able to, it made sense to spend a lot more money on affordable housing, because it wasn't just about affordable housing, it was about saving the city from real risk. And so Mayor Koch, even though the new commitment of resources the Bloomberg administration has made is significant, Mayor Koch still, in the average year with city money, spent twice what we're spending now in city capital. But it was really to do a different thing. I mean, it was to reclaim abandoned neighborhoods as opposed to try to figure out how to carve out affordability. I mean, I do think that of the four that you mentioned, the housing records of Mayor Koch and Mayor Bloomberg are certainly easier to tell a story about what's significantly positive about them than Mayors Dinkins or Giuliani. That's broader. That's not especially true on preservation and code enforcement, and I haven't looked at the data about conditions, and obviously conditions were much worse in the Koch era because, you know, abandonment meant that housing conditions were dramatically bad in so many places.
Ms. Marquez, in LA, the ramp up of the staff for the project and the aggressive code enforcement certainly, I'm sure, came with a price, but paid off unquestionably with a social return on investment. Was there a marked or at least quantifiable return on investment in real dollars that was noted in the city, vis-a-vis whether it was fines or improved conditions that led to more investment in the city?
I would say one important thing is that the code enforcement program is not paid for with city dollars. The code enforcement program is completely paid for by tenants. Right now, the fee is $36 a year, and so landlord pays it up front and then charges $3 a month through the rent. So 100% borne by tenants. And they were happy to do it, right? As a result of that, what were we at? Now, when we're done, about 1.7 million violations. We've calculated about $1.4 billion of reinvestment in that same housing stock, all private dollars by landlords. That's how we paid for it. What we do see is that as neighborhoods improve, our biggest challenge is going to be how we deal with gentrification. That's how much better the neighborhoods have become. And one thing that I now hear people complaining about, and that I've got to go deal with one of my colleagues in the Building and Safety Department, is that while we're inspecting the units, the, you know, small commercial establishments who have leaning garages, things that are falling apart, they're not following along. So the blight that's left in many of these on block by block is actually small commercial. It's no longer the housing itself. And so ultimately, there is no doubt that everyone has benefited, whether you're a tenant or you're the property owner.
Hi. I have a two-part comment and question. The comment part is I'd like to exact a pledge from everybody in this field never to use the term affordable housing again, unless perhaps they're referring to how to afford housing, the cost of providing it, because to my mind, when you talk about affordable housing, and you're talking about rents or the cost of buying a house, it's meaningless. The first issue is what does it cost to provide that housing? And if you're telling me it costs $500, $600, $700 a month to provide housing, and you know you've got people who can't afford that at 30% of income, they can't afford housing. Then we're talking about subsidies. We're not talking about affordable housing. We're talking about subsidy programs. And it doesn't do housing any service to discuss the two in the same breath. They should be talking about the cost of providing housing and subsidy programs.
If developers will agree to provide housing at the cost plus maybe a 10% markup, I'll entertain the idea of looking at a different.
Well, then
way
you'll
of
have no housing. And that's what, in fact, the Mitchell-Lama program proved. Because until you put the provisos in the Mitchell-Lama program to allow people to buy out, pay off their mortgages at the end of the process, nobody built anything under the Mitchell-Lama program. It was only the incentive of getting out that spurred the program. But the question I have, because I've loved this information about Los Angeles. I love that the tenants pay. I love that there are violations issued against tenants. And I'd like to explore some of the other differences that might make this program work in Los Angeles. For example, I know in New York, there are something over 500 violation codes. And there are very fine distinctions between them. You talked about a minimum standard. I think, you know, we could probably all in this room agree on 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 issues that would make sense to incorporate in the minimum standard. So I guess my question is, what are you really enforcing? And what has your experience in developing that?
That's a great question, because actually we enacted no new laws in terms of habitability standards to begin the program. So what we, locally, none. So what we enforce is the minimum state habitability code that all cities in California are responsible for. And this, if there's anything that I think is important to take back, is that this is a minimum mandatory program. No new housing code at all was enacted to do that. All we're doing is enforcing the law on a regular basis. Sure. You have to have screens on the windows. You can't have peeling paint in the sinks. You have to have hot water at a certain temperature. Well, I'm talking minimum habitability standards that anyone would agree is what it is. So nothing fancy. And I think what's important about it is that by sticking to the code that everyone knows and understands, right, that insurance companies base all their coverage on, everything, nothing new happened as a result of this, except for consistent enforcement and education on what those minimum standards are. And I think what has happened is that if a landlord hasn't done it for, you know, hasn't been involved in a minimum maintenance program, of course, you get deferred with that huge deferred maintenance bill, and then you're frightened. But if you, after this first time, we're most interested to see what happens after this next cycle. Now we've moved to 4 years. Cycle. And we're going to see what is it, how many slipped back, how many kind of really changed their business practices to maintain minimums, which is a lot less expensive to do month by month than it is if you run by every 5 years. And we'll come back to you perhaps and talk to you about what we have found and how the culture of doing business has changed. But that's a very important thing, just minimums. And what we're finding is that landlords, if they have to put in, you know, $1,000 to $2,000 per unit because they haven't done any maintenance for years and years and years, we're finding that some of them are willing now and saying, well, maybe because we have so much, you know, so much turnover, I'm willing to put in the $2,000 more to upgrade the unit completely. And we're finding that. And because we don't have what you call rent control, we have rent stabilization, because it's true that we have 100% decontrol. And the city, the units turn over so often that they know that eventually they're going to reap the benefit. And if they do it all now when it's cheaper, when that tenant moves out, they will get a better rent as a result. And that's what we're finding, that it works well in the market.
Sorry.
Hi. This is actually hopefully a brief statement, and I want a sort of reaction to it. It's kind of apropos to what you're doing, but I'm sort of maybe I'll frame it a little bit. If you read a basic microeconomic textbook, or if you read an economic textbook on some subject matter that has sort of a public policy aspect, there will be a description as to the difference between a public good and a private good. A public good is considered non-rivalrous and non-excludable. So a lamplight is a public good because you can't exclude a person's ability to see the light. And if they see it, it's non-rivalrous because it doesn't mean you can't see it. A hamburger is a private good. You can't have it. If I eat it, it's gone. Housing would seem to me to be a pure private good. It's basically called a lock. I lock the door. It's my apartment. It's not yours. Therefore, it's very unclear why government is involved in the housing industry at all, except in what you're doing, because information happens to be a public good. The same reason that you have cholesterol on food you buy, because you don't know how much cholesterol is in it. So it's beneficial for people to learn that. So that's, I just thought that's kind of a useful comment to understand in the context of New York, which has the most housing programs that probably of any city in the history of America, and has remarkably unaffordable housing, something like 300 or 400% above the national average. If you correct income data in New York City for the cost of living, New York City is one of the poorest places in the United States. And I mean, remarkably poor, and large part of it is the massively failed housing policies. And I just thought that might sort of be a thought to just share with you. Thanks.
You're a fun crowd. I would say to that, I appreciate your comment that maybe housing is an exception, but I would say that if housing doesn't function, children do worse in schools. All of the infrastructure needs grow worse. You have fires. You have all kinds of things that someone else in the government will have to pick up. And certainly, if to the degree that people have to come and save us from electrical fires and put everybody else out, it starts to be in the area of a public good as opposed to a private good. And so it's the interconnectedness of which we cannot escape, that we all live together. Unless we really want to live way out and have no neighbors and be completely self-sufficient, we are touching each other all of the time. And certainly in the area of housing, all of the things that happen in government that we all rely on without thinking about, just like breathing, have to work together. And I would say that in the issue of rental housing, that's part of the cost.
Definitely. My name is Paul Kirzner. I head up Con Edison's Renaissance Housing Program here in New York. Three quick questions on the LA. They're going to be quick. One.
You don't have to answer all three, though.
Do you have continued reinspection until compliance? Two, how do you deal with the access issue? Because in New York, only about one-third of apartments are inspected because of a lack of access. And three, how do you deal with owners who don't pay the fines? Is there some kind of a tax lien conversion?
Access is done by an enormous amount of outreach, so that we've even color-coded the letters. We have them posted in the buildings. We send them, of course, to the landlord. We give them an opportunity to reschedule. We send the letter to every tenant in the building so that they know that we're coming. I would say that as the program has moved on, we have greater and greater access to those buildings. And also because we still have a complaint program. We only receive about 15,000 complaints a year, even though we're inspecting now 200,000 units a year. We're able to have enormous amount of access. I think that ultimately, the openness with which this program was created, so that landlords know all about it and work on it, as do tenants, that it is not something so foreign. In fact, an odd kind of sad commentary about how well-known the program is now. We now have reports from the police department that for the first time robberies are happening based on people coming in purporting to be housing inspectors. So we're now so well-received that despite badges and identifications, we're actually now designing a uniform. Because now they let you in. So we've been able to really get into the culture of the city, and so that's not so much a problem anymore. And yes, we continually inspect until you comply. And if you get to the point where you are referred to the city attorney, then you have to pay for two extra inspections. Right now, that fee of $36 a year covers all of the inspections, unless you distinguish yourself for criminal enforcement, in which case now the cost of the continued inspections to compliance now is borne by the landlord because they're choosing not to comply.
All right. I think you can rest for a second. This is a very talented, well-educated, aggressive group, so... I think this issue, though, really almost more than any other, sparks just wonderful policy dialogues. You know, we have demand policies, and we have supply policies, and we have each one of those a set of issues of whether the benefits of government intervention exceed that or the costs of government intervention. Very, very difficult things. When I was looking at housing policy as a mayor, I couldn't even figure out. You know, it seemed to me housing policy was job policy, right, or transportation policy, or And so I appreciate your passion and your great ideas, and we'll ask all of the audience, even those who are totally free market, to thank you for your presentation. We're adjourned.